Coming up on Path to Zero.
To me, the notion that fossil fuels have to be eliminated is the incorrect notion. Carbon needs to be reduced.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero fans. We're coming to you today from Portland, Maine. And this is a really special episode of Path to Zero because it's being recorded at the annual conference of National Association of State Energy Officials, NASEO, as it's better known. This is an awesome gathering of great people. Attendees at this conference represent governors from each of the 56 U.S. states and territories. We've hosted dozens of special guests on Path to Zero, talking about subjects that range from environmental justice to new engine technologies. Today, I get the pleasure of being the special guest. I'm going to turn my hosting duties over to my good friend and NASEO's representative from Oregon, Alan Zelenka. Alan, welcome to Path to Zero. And well, I guess since you're the host, you can welcome me to my own show.
So welcome to your podcast, Tucker.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
My name is Alan Zelenka. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning and Innovation for the Oregon Department of Energy. My division works on energy efficiency, renewable energy, climate change, sustainable transportation, and alternative fuels. So it's only fitting and appropriate that NASEO would ask me to MC this podcast on propane and alternative fuel. So to start off with, why don't you tell us a fit cat, a fun fact to know and tell about yourself? And then could you please tell the audience a little bit about more about your background, how you became CEO, and a little bit about PERC, and what are the three coolest things that PERC does?
Well, I think I would have said the fun fact is that I am the self-proclaimed best bocce player in the world, but before I give you all that story, I'm going to say that I think I'm an engineer that can actually write a complete sentence. So I'm going to...
So there's one, Jeff.
We'll check. But you did say you like engineers, so that was nice. No, and what we do at PERC, I think a lot of people confuse PERC and MPGA because MPGA has always had a good relationship here, and Jake Peterson does a lot of work. PERC actually has no interest in lobby or policy. PERC is much more about, one, education, educating the general public as well as the propane marketers about how to do things the correct way, safe way, a lot about marketing and looking at the fuel. But I think what's exciting for all of us in this room is our main emphasis is about innovation. As this conversation has changed quickly over the last 4 or 5 years to where now climate and the environment is something we talk about, we're really between manufacturers and the product trying to see that we're keeping pace. And I would say 5 years ago when we talked about propane, we never talked about the environment. It was about portability, value, but now we talk almost exclusively about the environment. So it's been a nice start.
Yeah, reverse the order a little bit. So innovation's in my title. So why don't you start off with what's going on in innovation in the propane space?
Well, I think innovation is everywhere in the propane space, and as much as I come here and I always appreciate the way you talk about, you know, the world in which you live, and we think about electrification and where electricity is today and where it needs to go, I'm always struck by the fact that I think in many cases the pace of innovation is either at the same pace for us or maybe sometimes at a faster pace. So first off, we're innovating in the applications that you think about. So maybe the easy answer, let's just go to one that's often talked about. For a home to be truly clean, we've got to get rid of the gas stove. And I think the issue there is around NOx from the burner. So we're working on low NOx burners, and they'll be out in just a couple years. Kind of go to the other side of that spectrum, though, is about power. You've never really used propane and power probably in the same sentence, but today we're working with all kinds of size ranges and fuel types, whether it's fuel cells or standby generation, mobile generation. So engine technology is probably where we spend most of our time right now. We're going to announce in the next 6 months, we'll publicly announce. You could follow it through the financial papers if you needed to, but Cummins is making a major step forward using a propane engine, which is really unlike any engine that's ever come out. So, and the last piece of innovation, I think, for us is in the fuel, because as you well know, your world revolves at some point around the climate and carbon. And so propane sits today with a carbon intensity, shockingly enough, of about half the carbon intensity of the grid in the U.S. today. But we know the U.S. electrical grid is going to change. So we're driving that carbon content down.
Cool. So let's ask the headline question, that is, can propane have a role in state decarbonization plans? If so, what's the role? And what do you think is keeping states from making propane a more prominent part of state energy plans and policies?
Well, I hope everybody here would be disappointed if I didn't say yes, propane can have a role in a decarbonization plan. And I really wish I knew the answer. One of the reasons I come to places like NASIO and spend a lot of time out on the road talking with not only users, but builders and manufacturers, is why are we not in this conversation? I don't really have a perfect answer. As you work with the United Nations and you go a little bit bigger than just the U.S., we're certainly in the conversation to think about, you know, clean cooking throughout Africa, substituting for diesel fuel. If you were with me, in a lot of places you'd see that now propane is a choice for marine fuel. I don't know, many shipping is not really an American thing, but I don't really understand. I think we must have been connected automatically as the next thing to natural gas. And we really have never been viewed as some powerful thing. We're not the electric company. We're not the natural gas utility. And I think, A, that worked against us, because we're really not viewed. Clearly, one of the interesting statistics for me is we're about 3% of the U.S. energy mix. We're about 3% of the world's energy mix. We touch about 55% of the U.S. population and the world's population. So, you know, people would say, well, propane's not a part of my life, but I have a gas grill. You talk to anybody from Austin, Texas last winter, propane was a big part of their life, right? So I don't really know the true answer, but I think we haven't been in the power conversation. We've not been in transportation. We've been linked to natural gas, and I think all of those things are beginning to shift a bit now.
Yeah, so the linkage to natural gas, of course, propane is a fossil fuel. So how do you square the goals of many states, feds, businesses to achieve a zero carbon future, and not to mention customers wanting to see a zero carbon future, and transition away from fossil fuels, and where does propane fit in that?
Well, this is where, in a lot of situations, I'd flip the table over, except for these tables shouldn't be flipped over, so I won't, but I balk immediately at the conversation that seems to be out into the public domain, which is fossil fuels are evil and electricity is good. And I take that very much to be a the wrong statement, because I don't think fuels are binary, right? I don't think oil and coal are good, but also don't think that electricity made from coal or oil is good. So for this conversation about fossil fuels are binary and they're all bad and electricity is good, I much prefer to turn it around to what I think everybody in this room is working on is carbon. If we narrowly define the issue as climate, carbon is the challenge. And so there we need to work on having lower carbon. Propane, to a degree, natural gas, they're low carbon. You got C3, C1, depending on what you're talking about. And so I very much can say all day long, in fact, people don't realize this, in 38 states today, plus the District of Columbia, propane has a lower carbon intensity than the grid today. And so as we make a migration away from gasoline to electric, I don't think we're going to improve carbon, right? So to me, the notion that fossil fuels have to be eliminated is the incorrect notion. Carbon needs to be reduced. And we can talk about it for the next 30 minutes about ways that we can use propane to reduce carbon today.
Right, so decarbonization is the name of the game. Of course, it won't happen overnight, and probably take decades. So how do you see propane in the next 10 years, 20, 30 years kind of playing out over the next couple of decades as we go towards those 2050 goals of having a zero carbon future?
Yeah, So one of the things that's unique about us, and I should say, we've never been the dominant player, right? We've never been, as I said, the electric utility, the natural gas utility. And I find our position is very different than that of API or of AGA. And because we've always had to work well with other fuels. So with certainty, as we think about the future, and by the way, you give me a big window, 10, 20, 30 years, I'm much more confident of 10, 20 than I am 30 or 40, because I really haven't figured out batteries yet. Once, if we could figure out where batteries go, I think a lot of this cleans up, whether they're mobile batteries or stationary, but I'll back up just a second. We know we're going to work well with wind and solar. We know that that's going to be a part of the equation. We know that we're going to be a part, and we want to do the things we do well, and then leave it to other fuels to do. I think we heat your home when it's cold. We do that very well. We heat your water when you need hot water. We cook your food. We help you live outdoors. And then as we now think about the future, we're going to talk a lot more about power. And I don't really care where you want to step into that equation, mobile power. We want to talk a lot about power in your home. We might be the prime power source, but we're working well with solar and wind. I think that's the future. I think what's probably counter to most people's thinking, and I've studied this because we're not trying to just grow propane industry. We're trying to see how propane fits into this equation in the U.S. and then to a degree worldwide. I think natural gas is going to be around a long time, but just because of energy density and the way and the situation it is. So where we now see propane is replacing diesel, where diesel should be replaced. Mm-hmm. As big an advocate as I am for low carbon fuels that you call fossil fuels, you don't hear that word come out of my mouth, you'll hear me call them low carbon fuels. As much as I want to advocate for them, I am quick to say we should be substituting those fuels for oil and diesel. Mm-hmm. And you see that in transportation easily, but there, you know, you heard the governor of Maine talk about Maine's reliance on heating oil. You know, as we sit here in 2021, to me that's almost a crazy statement. Heating oil is not clean, it's not easy to use, it's not easy to store. There are so many places where this domestic fuel could be used to replace, to great benefit for the climate, to great benefit to our health, and I might argue to great benefit for the concepts that you've talked about all day today, which is environmental justice.
Yeah. Well, let's get into environmental justice a little bit. So fossil fuels, low carbon fuels, are often linked to energy systems that pollute and exploit, and particularly low-income and minority communities and communities on the front lines of climate change. For states seeking to integrate the benefits of propane into their policies, what should they know about propane's ability and the shortcomings of propane, what can't do to help address those equity and inclusion questions that everybody has at top of mind?
And this is an area that actually having the podcast has been helpful, because we've had a lot of people whose life was spent around justice and equity, and to hear their perspective has been really eye-opening to me. But the first thing that always strikes me is so many people that we're talking about here, you think about them often living in the city, but they also often live beyond the natural gas mains. They often today rely on one of the lower cost and more accessible fuels, which is propane. So I think two parts of this. One, I think access to affordable and clean fuels, hopefully clean and then renewable fuels. So I'll set you up a bit later for how we move that. But access is critical, because if you don't have access to it, it doesn't help you. If it's not affordable, it's not helping you. And I think the last piece about this is we're able to achieve so many of these carbon reduction goals without a lot of federal investment. I think the number we tend to promote is it would appear to get to the grid as we see it, that's going to take an investment of $20 to $25 trillion. That number seems to be socialized and accepted a while. Just suppose we could get to that cleaner climate, that healthier community, but we didn't spend $20 to $25 trillion in the grid modernization. We spend it on the things that really matter, like housing, medicine, society, infrastructure, all the things that we talk about today. To me, that begins to be a conversation that really is true justice. And because now we're not only getting to a cleaner climate, healthier community, access and affordability, but we've displaced that federal investment and allow it to be aimed at somewhere where it really has a more direct impact today.
Yeah, you mentioned batteries before. at Odo, we think of batteries as kind of the tofu of the energy world. It takes on the flavor of what you put in it. So if you put fossil fuels in it, then the batteries are fossil fuel batteries. If it's renewables, you put in, it becomes renewable. You mentioned working with solar and wind. Would you drill down a little bit more into that and talk about how does propane work with solar and wind?
Yeah, so actually that's something I do almost every day right now, because we're talking about going down a level. We're really down into the controls sequences, because that's really the last piece that has to be perfected. But I'm quick to say, I think solar and wind is an important part of today and the future. And for to not have a solar panel, or to not think about how wind could enter your home or your business, you're not really thinking in the modern world. But I mean, Europe is facing it today, right? The wind stopped blowing, oddly enough. Hydroelectric, all these clean sources of power are escaping us from time to time. You see it now in California, where hydro is way off. So you've got to have something that you can rely on all the time. And I think that's really where propane or other low carbon fuels, natural gas could as well. I mean, for most of you who don't know, while we have always talked about natural gas and propane being relatively similar, propane doesn't have that methane problem, right? The global warming potential for propane is 4. One of the reasons, if you go to Lidl or Aldi or Target, their refrigeration is generally today using propane, because the global warming potential is quite low. As we think about homes and light commercial for the future, I think they have to work with solar, they have to work with wind, but they need to have a fuel that's there. That begins to be really what we'll talk about is true resilience, right? So again, now fuels are doing what they need to do. And in our work right now, we think a home, a relatively nice size home, can get by with a 3 or 4 kilowatt power system and being supported by solar or wind. And that's probably the heating and electrical providing system for the home of the future.
So resiliency is top of mind of everybody at state energy offices and NASIO members in particular. How does propane fit into state resiliency plans?
Yeah, and I'm always glad to see, as I talk with many of you privately, just to kind of learn what you face every day. I know firsthand, I mean, I worked with Cassie when I first was introduced to NASIO about resiliency and emergency response. And it's something we had seen daily as we worked with police fleets and a lot of first responders about having propane-fueled vehicles. And it really paid out for them when times when they couldn't access gasoline or diesel. Kind of fast forward to today, though, resiliency to me is about the wide path. We need to choose the widest path possible, right? A narrow path of electrification, by definition, may be reliable until it's not, but it's certainly not resilient. And so what we see is the widest path, and propane being part of that path, is the true path to resiliency. One of the ways I like to think about it is, I think about a three-dimensional energy grid, and we all live it every day, right? Power lines are overhead, but short of a battery storage, power lines and electricity is a just-in-time inventory system, right? You have it until it's gone. Pretty much the same way for the underground part of that three-dimensional energy grid, it's pretty much a just-in-time inventory system. Natural gas comes in a pipe, and when the pipe is severed or whatever, the natural gas is gone. The one thing that's good in the middle, I tend to call it the vital center, is propane in one case. And the one unique thing about propane is you can store it. You can store it in a proper way for your home and a proper way for the environment. And now you're not really reliant on a just-in-time inventory system. Certainly as we go into the winter right now, storage is a big deal. But that three-dimensional energy grid, I think, has to work together. And I think when we think about resilience, one, the concept of storage, two, multiple fuels doing the jobs they do best, I think we begin to really see true resiliency.
Yeah, right. And you do get that with propane because it can be stored for a while, but like many regions of the country, Oregon's like 100% of our propane gets imported. That means it comes in by rail or by truck. So on those events, like a major earthquake or some other kind of disaster that goes beyond 3 or 4 days, the transportation networks are likely to be screwed up, damaged, and it's as is expected, trying to get into the Willamette Valley on the west side of the Cascade Mountains in Oregon. So how does the propane industry, do they have a plan about how to help distribute propane to areas in post-disaster, and such as in Oregon or the Pacific Northwest. Are you contemplating a post-disaster planning effort at the national or state level?
Yeah, Alan, that's a great question, and it's something we don't talk about. So we certainly do that at the local level. And I think that's one reason you see Jake and NPGA, you know, trying to be close with individual states, because it at some level, the logistics, the supply, and the demand, all of that is more at a local level than a national level. But I would say, I mean, I know I personally worked with NASIO around emergency response, but today I think we are in planning right now with three different states and one region in a disaster response plan. So I think for you, I was in the natural gas business, and when I moved over into propane, I was always struck by, in the natural gas business, it's all underground, the pipe flows, and no matter whether you're flowing one decatherm or 100 decatherms, you don't see it. I think a problem of the propane industry, but also a benefit, is that we're multimodal. We have access to rail. We have access to trucks. If we don't have enough trucks, we can bring trucks from Pennsylvania to Oregon. And you see us do that. You saw us do that last winter when the crops were way bigger, way wetter than we thought. And so that transportation network tends to go to the weakest link. But I would say, anybody in this room, if you're interested in kind of a thoughtful disaster plan, then PERC and NPGA are very willing to do that. We do it routinely around natural disasters. We did it in Texas twice. We do it regularly with FEMA as even a hurricane begins. And now we're getting better at, even knowing today where we might have generators that are available, who has generators in stock, seeing that not only Home Depot or Lowe's and Menards has them, but also that where we know where Generac has them and Briggs has. So we've come a long ways in that planning. But I would say at some level, it's very much at a local level. That's where we want to do it. And I encourage people to reach out to us and talk about that.
Yeah, a lot of state energy offices have emergency fuel plans. And and as you said, practice makes perfect. Unfortunately, we've had a lot of opportunity to practice getting this down. In Oregon, we have a clean fuels program. California has one too. And it classifies fuel by their carbon intensity. And propane has a carbon intensity score of about 83, gasoline about 101, and diesel about 102. So propane provides about a 20% reduction in carbon when used in vehicles. And Oregon has over 1,100 school buses that are done by propane. There's a little thing that was put by NPGA about school buses. So that's about 14% of our fleet, which is actually pretty high. We're sixth in the country for a state with only 5 million people. So propane can be an alternative transportation fuel that reduces greenhouse gas emissions. So how does propane fit into the transportation decarb plans of states?
Maybe if I said nothing else that anybody takes away, I hope you'll take this away. I think there are only two ways to transport a kid to school safely. And when I say safely, I mean in a much broader sense, thinking about the environment in which they are in. And the studies are shocking. But children that ride to school in low emission buses test higher in math and science than those who don't. I can explain why, but there's only two ways to get children to school safely. One is in a propane bus, one is in an electric bus. How you choose to do it is almost irrelevant to me as long as you make one of those two choices. Many places, they have to make a choice because either they have range or they have payload issues or for whatever reason, one fuel suits them better. But the real advantage in propane transportation for school buses is that basically you can buy four propane buses for one electric bus.
Yeah.
And while both choices are fine, the real remedy to improving your school system's financial health, your children's real health, is faster you get rid of dirty diesel buses, the faster your kids are getting to a financially stronger school and they're arriving healthy. And by choosing propane, you do it generally four times as fast. This is an area that I've actually been involved with student transportation since it began. And people don't realize it. The reason we didn't do it for any reason other than for emissions. Boston started by saying the superintendent there saw what NOx emissions were doing to children. And on another day, I would talk about whether I believe climate issues are more important than health issues, but I'm a person who sees firsthand the detriment of NOx and asthma and this the heartache it causes. And so you'll never hear me talk about climate without quickly going to health and then finally finishing with justice. But in Boston, it was all about NOx emissions. It was all about asthma and what this the horrific air that the children were breathing. And fast forward, once we had a couple thousand in, we saw that there was a pretty good cost savings. And then we rode that for a while, and now we're back to strictly emissions. I mean, this statistic we put out, which is a shocking statistic, if we change from diesel to propane across the country, we'd save enough money from that fleet operation to put 23,000 teachers in the classroom. That's the order of magnitude you begin to talk about, is a safer bus, a healthier bus, and save enough money to change education across the country. And that's, I get passionate about that. And I find that people find the next step for you, I think, is, well, electrification of my fleet is the only path to a clean climate. I hope you begin to see that there may be another path. Thank you for talking about carbon intensity. And carbon intensity, I can talk about it nationally, but I'm more interested in talking about it on a state-by-state basis. An electric vehicle is only as clean as your grid is, right? And so today, as I said, in 38 states in the District of Columbia, while we don't have more propane school buses, more paratransit, more medium-duty fleet, you're not going to hear me talk about cars, right? You want to drive whatever you want to drive, it's fine. I want to talk about fleets where payload and range matter, and those are the fleets we focus on. But there, it's a triple win, right? The fleet tends to be more economical to operate, even compared to electricity, according to some of the first studies coming out of the Department of Energy. The communities are cleaner, and it's just it's a better situation. It is a part of the solution. Clearly not the solution, a part of the solution.
Right, one of the arrows in the quiver. Right. So while we go towards cleaning up our electrical grid, getting towards decarbonization by 2050, and as battery costs start to drop down, so that upfront cost of electric bus is smaller, it seems to me that compared to diesel, propane is a good alternative. In fact, you were telling me that Arcadia National Park, just up the road here a little ways, is because of air quality concerns, is using propane.
Tremendous. Arcadia was a place that we really started with the national park. They knew they had to get away from diesel, and they looked at the variety of options. They chose propane, and I think 2 years later, it's been a smashing success. I think that's a great example where, again, as you think about how to decarbonize, part of what frustrates me is we do need to decarbonize, but most of our solutions, if they're a decade, 2 decades, I mean, I was talking to Bill Gates about small modular nuclear, and you tell me how far out that solution is. He probably differs in his opinion of that, but 20 years, 30 years, never years, I don't know. And so we've got to think about solutions, how to get to a cleaner climate today. Substituting propane wherever you're using diesel or heating oil is just the easy choice right now. In transportation, in medium-duty transportation particularly, school transportation, packages, water delivery, beverage delivery, it's really the step that should happen. And as I drive around, anywhere I go, when I see a diesel truck, I hear a diesel truck, I smell a diesel truck, I see that puff of black smoke when they pull away from a stop sign, and I went, that's all gone if they would choose propane. And by the way, they save 50% of their operating cost. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Good transition. So I'll ask one more question, then open it up if anybody has a question from the audience. What about renewable propane?
Yeah.
Where does it come from? How much is there? Is it kind of a pipe dream or a tank dream, I guess, in propane talk? What's the projection for future?
So thanks for asking about that, because I think we have been a bit behind on renewable fuels. And I think it took about 2 or 3 years into California to realize that we needed to stop talking about the clean advantages of conventional propane and at least beginning to see the pattern, because to your point, 20, 30 years, I'm sure, you know, we'll need to have renewable fuels. So what is renewable propane today? It comes from anywhere we're making renewable diesel from food, oils, animal waste. If we really occupied just what's already built, we'd have about 300 million gallons. Our numbers are not particularly different than renewable natural gas in terms of the percentage. Our goal is to get to have pathways to 1 million gallons. That's kind of our total transportation demand, and before we start moving into some regular homes. So here are pathways. The conventional pathway is 300 million gallons through biodiesel. But probably more exciting to me, and maybe even more exciting to you, is you begin to think about what do we really do about methane? That I think we are really looking at some plasma technologies and some technologies that will convert methane to either syngas or ultimately to a renewable propane. I will say this, if you knew where to look today, and I told you, you see carbon zero molecules on the road today that we're testing. It's, 2 years ago, I would never have talked about this. Now I can show a carbon zero molecule, and that's renewable propane, propane, and dimethyl ether. Now, unless you maybe are a transportation freak, you don't know much about renewable dimethyl ether or renewable DME, but the carbon intensity is minus 278. So there, propane and dimethyl ether work together really well. So we're demoing right now fleets running a carbon zero molecule.
Cool. Is there any questions from the audience? Anybody want to ask something?
The boss is going to ask a question. I don't like that.
I'll make it maybe quick.
Here's the microphone, Dave.
Appreciate your comments around school buses and switching out. I think that's a great topic. I wanted to also just say thanks to PERC and NPGA for the energy emergency response cooperation. And on that note of resilience, something that we began to see a few years ago were more propane backup generators. And I wonder if you could just say a few words. It's obviously a really good diesel replacement for functionality for a bunch of reasons. Can you speak to any trends that you're seeing there? Is that really taking off, or any data you can offer?
Yeah, thank you. I think the last 3 or 4 years, again, anywhere diesel is being used, particularly if it's not being used at some industrial scale, we find that propane should be in the consideration set. So we go back and say, why is it not being used? And so a lot of people, it was around size, it was around durability. And I think now we've at least broken the mold. We're powering ships all around the world with propane that 5 years ago we said, well, propane couldn't do things that are that scale. We've spent years working with Generac and Briggs and Kohler to, in fact, the PGA, Whistling Straits, you know what provided all the temporary power? Propane. Propane in a European brand generator, but I think it gives you an idea of where we have come now. So we tend to completely agree. Anyone who's using a diesel generator, certainly at their home, and they might as well be driving a Model T as well, because you've got to store diesel fuel. It's not good to store. It's not good to use. But as we move up the food chain, you really see us begin to talk about combined heat and power systems, even for residential and light power. There you have the basics you need of the electric generation, 3 to 4 kilowatts. You have that waste heat, which now you use for your water. It's essentially free. And then you can actually build the rest of your solar networks around it. So in power gen, whether it's stationary, mobile, backup, we have really worked on durability. And our team, so I'm talking about small scale things, 5 kW, 3 kW, but our team now, and we're working with manufacturers in 100, 200, up to 300 kW, because now we at least now have got engineering, science, manufacturing has finally caught up. And we're going to demonstrate that to the world with this Cummins 6.7 liter engine. But we now, that's not unique. That's just the first of that next wave. So thanks for a question. But again, if you have a diesel generator at home, just get a Model T and drive it as well.
Take one more question.
All right, thanks so much. First, clarifying, it's Megan Levy from Wisconsin. Did you say you used a European generator at Whistling Straits in Wisconsin in between Kohler and Generac? Holy moly, we'll talk about that later.
The irony was not lost on us either.
Whew. However, I wanted to follow up on the renewable propane, because I know this isn't your job to track supply, and this year is going to be a challenging one, particularly in terms of, you know, our EJ communities we've been talking about, and the price of propane's already up. So that makes me think, particularly in a state which produces almost no energy of its own except for biofuels, are we doing this production of at least the 300 the number of gallons, is that actually happening, or is that still kind of a science experiment at this time? And what can we do to help bring that along? Because I really think, you know, to David's point, we've appreciated your assistance with disaster recovery and our resilience planning, and energy security is about diversity. So we don't want to see a narrow path forward. It's got to be a wide path. It's got to have thermal energy, and we're going to need that. I think we're going to need that renewable propane.
So first off, thank you for finally taking your mask off. I've been looking for you for 3 days, and now I found you. So that's nice. That's that when people you don't see but once a year, and now you only see them through their eyes. So I've been looking for you for 3 days. But to that point, let me answer. I am not talking about science experiments when I talk about 300 million gallons that can come from renewable diesel. Now, are we making that today? No, we're making about 12 million, but kind of we're in the contract stage with 50, 60 million. But 300 million gallons are available to us from existing renewable diesel plants. Thank you for your point about winter planning. I think I'd be wrong to not be sitting and say, this is going to be a strange winter. Again, because propane has the ability to be stored, we're out right now in a massive public campaign to say, the one thing you can do to protect yourself is to go into the winter filled up. I would say, if I represent the energy complex today, we have been shocked at the European demand, we've been shocked at the Asian demand, and natural gas, if you don't follow things, natural gas, which when I left the natural gas industry, we would sell all we could for $2.50 a decatherm. Europe is willing to pay $18, and the Chinese don't care what they pay. They're going to pay for it. So the whole energy complex has risen. This winter could be dicey. The last piece of that is beyond supply and demand, but the logistics piece in the middle. And as you travel, you see there aren't enough servers in a restaurant, there aren't enough pilots on a plane. There are also, let's don't kid ourselves, there are not enough carpenters or truck drivers. So we're very concerned about this winter. One reason we again believe in a renewable supply. I would say we think we're a year or two away from methane turning to propane in places that methane has previously been flared. I think that's a double win. One, it gives us a better renewable supply. Two, it gives us a cleaner climate. So we kind of think that's a double win. But to your point, we're willing to work with anybody that thinks they have a renewable diesel refinery. We've worked with NREL to have a third-party study that shows a refiner where to put the pipes, how to do the storage, what it costs them, and what the market looks like. So I'm happy to work with any of you in your own state to talk to your renewable diesel refiners about that.
Well, thank you, Tucker. It's been fun turning the tables on you and having you be the guest. I think you did pretty good as a guest, though. Stay tuned next week, where Tucker's going to talk about the intricacies of bocce ball.
That's right. Thank you all for being here.
Alan, you did a great job, and it's been a pleasure for me to be with you and all of you at NASIO today as we travel the path to zero.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us. And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts.